Welcome to the fourth episode of the second season of the RJOS podcast. I'm your host, Liana Tedesco. This season, we will be highlighting the winners of the He for She, the She for She, and the Courage Awards. It's been such an honor to connect with our guests, learn about who they are, and how they became to be our esteemed award winners, and what the Ruth Jackson Orthopedic Society means to them. We also discuss the future and how we, the listeners, can create a better and more equitable future for those interested in orthopedic surgery. My next guest is Dr. Lorraine Boache. She is an assistant professor in the Department of Orthopedic Surgery at the University of Pennsylvania in the Foot and Ankle Division. She completed her residency training at the University of Pittsburgh and her foot and ankle fellowship at Brigham and Women's in Boston. Throughout her training, she has been intimately involved with the DEI efforts of orthopedic surgeons nationally and within her own program. She is the winner of the 2023 Courage Award, which honors that individual who defines courage and conviction in representing what is right to protect and help others. Dr. Boache may be our youngest guest, but she has certainly made her mark. Let's get to it. So first and foremost, I would like to thank today's guest, Dr. Lorraine Boache, for joining us today. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, this is a great treat.
Definitely excited to be here.
So for our listeners, can you tell them a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, for sure. So I am currently an assistant professor in the Department of Orthopedic Surgery at the University of Pennsylvania, and I've been on faculty since September 2022. But I grew up in Northern Jersey. I went to Yale for undergrad, and then I was at Pitt for med school, and I stayed there for residency, and then went on to the Brigham for a fellowship in foot and ankle surgery.
So tell us a little bit about how you chose orthopedics. How did you come to it?
Yeah, absolutely. So I have always been pretty fascinated with trying to understand how people engage with their environment, and if I could allow people to have sort of restored function and therefore improve their self-perception, it was super meaningful to me. So ultimately, the goal was to be able to understand kind of the basic workings of the human body and allow people to engage with their world in the way that makes sense to them.
Oh, I love that answer. How you engage with your environment. That's a new one. I haven't heard that. And you are a foot and ankle specialist. So tell us how you chose foot and ankle. What made you excited about it?
Yeah. So everyone jokes that choosing foot and ankle is basically not choosing a subspecialty and that every day is totally different, right? So there's a little bit of arthroplasty, a little bit of deformity, some sports trauma, really jack of all trades. And so I think the inherent variety was super appealing to me. And it's nice to basically have like an untapped market of kind of patient pathology and just different kind of demographics of folks. So I see all kinds of people in all stages of mobility. So it's really the full spectrum of life.
That's great. So I've talked to some other people about this and I would love to get your perspective on mentorship and maybe if you could talk a little bit about some of your own mentors, orthopedic or otherwise, and how they have been important to you.
Yeah, I think I'd be remiss to not talk about my parents in this. I think their journeys respectively, super impactful in my trajectory for obvious reasons, but also in terms of the values that they instilled. When I think about it, just understanding the amount of grit and tenacity it took to, you know, come from a different country and make something out of yourself. So much of how I've kind of framed my career has been based on just choosing a goal, finding a path, and then essentially thinking of every way to accomplish it and finding help along the way. And I think to that end, some of the help I found along the way, most impactful, I'd say, probably, obviously, the late Dr. Freddie Fu. He was chairman when I was a medical student at Pitt and really like made me fall in love with UPMC. And so as a Northern Jersey girl, I never anticipated being in Pittsburgh for 9 years, which just seems like the crux of my like adult life. But certainly the way that he ran the department and the way that he kind of encouraged us all to be nothing but ourselves and to remember that being unique is to be special. And that part is the thing that makes our ability to care for patients kind of so important. Just remembering that there are a variety of patients, variety of pathology, but ultimately we've got a really individualized care in the context of who someone is and what they're trying to get back to. So, and then obviously his predecessor, or sorry, his start from the top, next in line after Dr. Fu is Dr. Matt Kogan. And I met him when he was actually a fellow at HSS. I was a very young first year med student, doing summer research at HSS, and I didn't realize how much our paths would cross as I continued my career. So he was a fun fellow and I was a summer fellow, and I learned a lot from him then, and that continued as he became one of the attendings in foot and ankle at Pitt, and then eventually became our program director and now is chair.
That's, I think, such a great story of how you like need to engage with the people around you, because you never know who's going to be an important mentor, friend, advisor. So that's awesome that you were able to kind of connect with him at so many time points in your, you know, your young career. We have a lot of people, or I've had a few guests on this podcast who are very seasoned, but I'm excited to talk to someone who's just starting out. Because I think it's interesting to hear how you have been able to, you know, access and use your mentors in these early stages. What do you think is the most important thing you can do as a mentee to engage with your mentors?
Yeah, I think truly like asking for help. I think there is maybe too much of a culture of shame or secrecy if there's something that's maybe not going as well as you want it to. And I think the ability to really help in sort of affect positive change is maybe hampered by some of that. So I think I've had a lot of success when, you know, you've got to cultivate a culture of transparency, but certainly building that trust early on in the relationship is crucial. But I think folks are really not surprised by much. And so if you think whatever you're going through is like, you know, uniquely bad or disappointing or whatever, it's probably not. And there's definitely someone that can help get you through that.
What have been some of the obstacles you've had like in your first year of practice that you maybe wish you'd known about?
Oh my gosh. I don't know how much time we have. It's tough. I think you have this sort of sense that you've arrived, and I think in many ways you have, but you almost feel like an intern again, in that there are so many things you've not seen in fellowship or residency, and you realize that you are truly in charge. And you know, there's plenty of people to ask and many points of kind of encouragement and advice and that sort of thing. But I think ultimately understanding that you know enough to make the right decision and take the best care of your patients is tough. But I think kind of the amount of preparedness that you've had throughout training is something that we don't really think about. But ultimately, I've heard from all my partners and some other folks that are in my same stage that it is a very, we really have committed to lifelong learning. And that definitely shows the first time you see, you know, something very new in your clinic as a first year attending.
I bet. I mean, I'm doing hand and upper extremity fellowship, and I feel like I have 16 cases this week and every case is different.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm like, how can I possibly learn all of this?
Yeah.
And I think the answer is I won't, but I'll always be learning. So I think that's
a great
thing to keep in mind. I want to switch gears a little bit and talk a little bit about the Ruth Jackson Society. How did you first learn about it?
Yeah, so I think to our point of mentorship before, I think a combination of Fu and Hogan had told me about RJOS, and I applied to one of the medical student grants to come to RJOS in, I think it was maybe my second year of medical school. And it was so fun because I don't think that I'd gone to a meeting of that size before, and just seeing so many different accomplished people with similar backgrounds to me was incredible. So I got to go without kind of the burden of all the financial constraints, which was amazing. And they had kind of special programming for us and very sweetly announced all of our names. And everyone was like really excited that there was a whole crop of kind of the next generation around. So it was really neat.
Yeah, I think that's such a great thing that RJOS does, is like acknowledges all the people who have come, whether it's the medical students, the residents. You know, I think they're doing a really good job of trying to get in on the ground floor and try to keep people engaged, which is, I think, I'm sure we'll get into it a little bit later when we talk about some other things, but it's important for, you know, building out our specialty and creating a more diverse and inclusive environment, just making people feel included.
Totally.
What are your thoughts on the importance of RJOS? Why do you think that it has made such a difference for so many people?
I think it is an incredible resource for folks that maybe don't have departments that are as visually diverse as others. And I think it provides a network of people that, you know, maybe have a source of commonality. And I think just seeing folks that have gone through the process and realizing, like, you can do it in the shoes that you're born in. And it is so helpful to have such a large group. I think just the sheer numbers. I remember being a med student and looking around the room and just being like, wow, like, I'm so impressed that there's so many people. Because I didn't know the true scope of it. And I think, you know, realizing how accomplished so many of these people are, and how they've been able to make an impact, like, you know, at their own respective institutions, but then also in their local communities. I think really a lot of the reach, I think they probably haven't even understood the range of it and the capacity to inspire other people. I think just seeing photos of Ruth Jackson early on, and all their initiatives, and realizing, like, one, like, how much community was within the group of folks, and realizing that that was going to be a network that I could kind of lean on as I went through my career was huge.
Mm-hmm. Are you currently involved in RJOS in any specific way, like any committees or any projects? Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so I currently serve as the Diversity Advisory Board liaison to the AOS, and it's a pretty cool role. I think it's interesting to see kind of the inner workings of both sides of it, but the long and short is that organization, that subcommittee rather, is designed at figuring out the kind of funding allocations for some of the new grants that we've received to kind of bolster DEI missions within orthopedics. And so it's fun because I think seeing just how many different ideas people have and sort of the respective environments that people are coming from and how much kind of diversity there is in the amount of diversity there is within programs is pretty interesting. And I did apply for another committee membership, so fingers crossed. So we'll see about that one next.
That's great. I'm sure your chances are good. I'd love to talk a little bit more about your work with the DAB, because I actually, this is more for us, but I served on the membership council of AOS as my role as resident assembly chair. And we worked a little bit with the DAB. So I'm curious, what initiatives were you most excited about that they were working on? There were some cool stuff.
Yeah, the biggest thing I think is the idea grants. And that has been super interesting because it is, you know, I think there's some like cheeky quote of like, no money, no mission or something like that. But it's just nice to see how much support there is from a fiscal side, because ultimately the initiatives that they're working on, really many of them wouldn't launch in the way that they ought to without that backing. And then the other part of it is kind of looking at partnerships of more kind of nascent or up and coming affinity groups. And there's the opportunity for a bit of partnership with AOS through the DAB for kind of specific programming during the annual meeting. And that's a really neat way for people to see more of the initiatives that are going on within these up and kind of newer groups, and to one, kind of boost membership, and then two, get the word out and then be able to really further the agendas there.
So you won the Courage Award, which is awesome. Can you talk a little bit about your experience that led to this, you know, acknowledgement of what you were able to do?
Yeah, I think, you know, without getting into the weeds of it all, I was chief resident, and it was in kind of the thickest of times, like mid-pandemic, with a lot of the recent kind of crowd/police brutality things in the wake of George Floyd. And I think in our attempts to have kind of open discussions, conversations maybe went a different direction. And I think for some maybe less kind of further along residents, it was difficult to navigate and kind of speak out about things that made them uncomfortable. And I think in that moment, I decided that I was fine risking it all and speaking up, and maybe, you know, at the risk of talking out of turn, it was worth it to say what was right. And in the moment, I didn't necessarily second guess it because it just felt like I had to. You know, I think there are certain things that maybe the impulses we control, but on this one, I was like, I don't know how I can continue without kind of addressing this and, you know, giving the other person or parties involved the opportunity to discuss it, but just one, in hopes of understanding from their perspective, and then two, to shed light on how the experience could have gone very differently for someone who has less agency in the scenario.
I think it's important to think about the environment that you were in that situation. Like, being a resident, I mean, you were a chief, so it's a little bit different, but, you know, in that type of hierarchy of resident attending, you know, I think it's a testament to the type of place you trained at that you were able to stand up and say what you're, I don't agree with what you're saying, and maybe we should think about this from another perspective.
No, that's spot on. And I think that is, I was lucky to have that. And I think the risks of speaking up in an environment that isn't open to that, you know, certainly worse. But ultimately, I think the culture there permitted that. And I think the ensuing conversation certainly was reflective of that.
I think there has been a tremendous amount of growth in orthopedics in this particular realm, but of course we are still far behind. You know, what do you think some of the obstacles are? I think both of us trained in places where this wasn't as big of a deal, but not every program is as welcoming, inclusive. What do you think some of the obstacles are?
Yeah, you know, it is tough because I think as much as we try to kind of itemize the reasons and kind of create literature around it and then kind of initiatives to mitigate that, I think it's the intangibles, right? Like, if you don't see anyone that even remotely looks like you, whether on faculty or as a resident, I think you just assume that it's not for you. Mm-hmm. And I think what we don't necessarily pay attention to is, you know, it may be, you know, specific people within the orthopedic community, but, you know, I remember when I was a med student and I said I wanted to do ortho, like, the internal medicine people were like, nah, like, you really? And so I think, you know, the whole ethos of the prototypical ortho bro, if you want to use that kind of moniker, but I think that has permeated so much of medical culture in general that it's tough to dissuade people from perpetuating that in aspiring kind of ortho med students. And so I don't know how to kind of unwrite that until the rest of our society kind of sees that you don't necessarily have to have a certain physique to do ortho or certain demographic or whatever. But I think it is the sense of belonging. And until people from all demographics really feel like they could, you know, copy paste themselves into any program, we probably have more work to do.
I think that's such a funny point. And I got that when I was a med student too, where it's like the people in other specialties, it's not the ortho people necessarily saying, oh, you shouldn't do this. It's other specialties because they still have a lot of biases. I mean, how often right. are you seeing a consult in the ER and you're like, hi, I'm Dr. Bawachere from orthopedics. And they're like, where's the orthopedic doctor? I'm like, I just introduced myself. You know?
Yep. Could be scenes from residency for me.
I know. I mean, scenes from today for me.
Truth. Scenes from my own OR.
Is a doctor coming in today? I just introduced myself. No, I think that's it's a good point. And I think we don't talk about it that often. We talk about orthopedics being this white male dominated specialty because we're in it, but no, we don't talk a lot about the outside perspectives. And maybe we should focus a little bit on educating them as well.
Yeah, I think it's time.
just backtracking a bit, I'd love to know what it meant to you to have been acknowledged for your actions that led to you winning the Courage Award. What did that mean for you in your young, very young career?
Oh, yeah. I honestly, shocked. I remember being completely floored. I think I might have told the person that told me that, like, are you sure? Like, did you mean to call me? And they were like, okay, like, let's backtrack and go over what happened here. And so, you know, I think in these moments, you realize the little things that had such an impact on other folks are quite important. And I think if we can all get to a spot where we're acting not out of, you know, fear of consequences, but with the collective sense of progress in mind, I think, you know, it's awesome to be honored for like my clinical acumen or research stuff or any of my OR skills. But I think, you know, being recognized for my character, like that is incredibly meaningful. Just knowing that doing the right thing mattered and made a difference for someone, I think was really special.
You know, we've talked about this a little bit, but have you seen any specific initiatives that have been particularly beneficial in terms of like improving diversity, whether it be gender diversity or racial diversity? You know, what have you seen in your time? Because I think even in like my time as a from medical student to resident, it seems to have improved quite a bit.
Yeah, I think we're getting there little by little. Yeah, I think a couple of things. Well, I think I'll think of the ones that were kind of uniquely important for me. Like when I was looking at sub-Is, there were a couple of programs that had scholarships, and that was huge for me because, you know, paying rent to where I lived and then finding a new place to live and then funding that month-long opportunity is definitely tough. So I think it was really helpful to kind of eliminate another barrier to having people go to different programs and, you know, see a different sort of residency and be able to kind of have that next level of consideration, because I think, you know, all the data shows that folks that rotate at certain schools or certain programs or, you know, their home programs tend to be the places where people end up. So I think, you know, it's maybe different in the age of Zoom, you know, where folks can do like the virtual meet and greets. I think that's super helpful. There's also kind of moves to do these virtual kind of sub-Is or boot camps where you're really interfacing with the program, whether it's faculty or residents. But I think just having like less stressful interactions in a sustained fashion is super helpful, because it allows people obviously to be their best selves. And I think understanding kind of who people are tends to be the reason that people end up doing well or kind of fitting at a certain program. So I think having, you know, earlier exposure to programs is certainly key. And I think if we're able to kind of allow medical students at kind of reasonable cadences to interface with programs, I think anything we can do to kind of unlock that would be great.
Yeah, I think it's about access.
Absolutely.
Kind of pulling back the curtain a little bit, especially given how competitive residency is becoming with the match rates being crazy low, just so many people applying for our limited mm-hmm. amount of spots, which is, you know, it's flattering because it is the best career, but
there you go.
We want to make sure, I think, as a community, that we're doing our best to get all the people in who want to be here, because it's always good to have good people. Besides access, are there any other things that come to mind when you think about improving like DEI efforts moving forward, or anything that you know of that's in the pipeline that you're excited about?
Yeah, you know, I think in my like jack of all trades persona, there are a lot of affinity groups that I think play to many of kind of the efforts to do this, whether on a access like medical student level, but then also kind of amplifying and sponsoring folks further along in their career So like MSOS is great because I think that's also really empowering the medical students to find ways to, one, like lead, and two, really demystify the application process, because I think since we applied, it's very different. And then IOTA is another group that is looking at things on an international level. And that's super interesting because I think there are so many different components of identity. I think keeping in mind the broader orthopedic landscape is super helpful. One of the initiatives there is thinking about a speaker list, and you know, instead of having the same, you know, 10 people talk about X topic, you know, thinking about who's speaking and allowing folks from other backgrounds to kind of take up the helm is really helpful. And I think kind of sustained mentorship is really crucial. Again, if you're not at a program where you've got access to people who are willing to really take an active interest in your professional advancement, then I'm on the mentorship committee in the Gladden Society, and we're working on kind of creating little clusters of mentorship cohorts and groups so that you're able to learn from other folks and residents within your little cohort. But then, you know, you've got a pool of kind of senior-ish people to be able to kind of coach you along.
You sound busy.
Oversubscribed, but very happy.
Too many tabs open is what I like, how I like to say it. If you could see my Google Chrome right now, you'd probably scream.
I love it.
How do you think we can get people to engage with this topic? I mean, I think everyone knows it's something they should think about, but how do we get people to engage with it? Because I think continuously saying we need to improve these efforts is important. People have to think about it, but people have to engage with it. And what do you think are some of the obstacles, or like, how do we get people to do it?
Yeah, I mean, I think any sort of behavior change is going to be met with a reasonable amount of inertia. And it probably feels like an overwhelming Herculean task to, you know, dismantle some sort of systemic kind of empire that we have. And so ultimately, I think if we can kind of bit by bit, come up with actual sort of not protocols necessarily, but like things that are more tried and true.
So that folks, actionable things.
There we go. Yeah. Like the ideas are there, but like, here's what you actually should do based on data. Cause you know, we all love evidence-based things. So, you know, I think it seems like folks that are interested, but maybe unsure of what to do can feel a little bit stymied. And then certainly like working in a silo is not great. And I think if, maybe it's like the collective residency, maybe it's RJOS, maybe it's AOS, someone. But I think there are ways that we can, one, work together to, you know, achieve the same goal of really just making ortho look like the rest of any profession, which is diverse.
Right. Well, I think that's a great place to start wrapping up. My closing question, I'm asking everyone this, is what advice would you give to your younger self? Or what advice do you wish that someone had given you?
Oh gosh, that is a really good one. If I could talk to little Lorraine, I would tell her that really like don't take yourself too seriously too early. I think a lot of the joy in this career is realizing how much you will grow and change throughout the process. And I think, you know, we're all relatively type A, and it's pretty easy to be stressed out about, you know, being truly perfect in all of the ways that we aspire to be. But ultimately, a part of the enjoyment of this is realizing how much is going to be different and how much you'll continue to learn throughout. So I would say keep trucking.
That's great advice. I'm partially asking this question so I can get some good advice.
Yep. Questions for you. We love it.
That's great. Well, Dr. Bawache, thank you so much for joining me. This was such a great conversation. And I'm happy to have had you on the podcast.
Oh, it was great talking to you. And thank you. I appreciate being on here.
I hope you enjoyed our conversation. If you're interested in learning more about some of the programs offered by the Ruth Jackson Orthopedic Society or getting involved in our committees, check out our show notes. On another note, the RJOS annual meeting is coming up. Please join us in San Francisco on February 12, 2024. In addition to the annual meeting, RJOS is hosting its first annual research day to showcase the research of our membership. Visit rjos.org/events to learn more. Until next time, I'm your host, Liana Tedesco, and this was the RJOS podcast.